to PRN, Pause, Renew, Next, a podcast about soul care, scripture, and stories of faith. I'm Jenny Detweiler, and friends, on this podcast, you know I love to talk about faith and mental health, and today's episode covers both of those things. It was a privilege to get to talk to Erica Anderson. She's the author of a new book that just released this month called Freely Sober, Rethinking Alcohol Through the Lens of Faith. Now, you know, addiction is not something we've talked about a ton on this podcast, but it really deserves some time and attention because there are so many people that struggle or who know somebody who is struggling and may be hidden in plain sight outside of the church, but also inside of the church. And one of the things I love about Erica and our conversation and her book is that she really focuses on how alcohol is marketed to and affects women specifically. So if this is an area you have questions in for yourself, I hope you'll stick around and listen to the whole episode. If it's something that you don't know a lot about, but you're interested to learn more, I hope you'll stick around for the whole episode. I think it's a great conversation and also a gentle invitation, as Erica says, to reconsider our relationship with alcohol from a posture of honesty, curiosity, and self-compassion. So with that, let's jump into the conversation. Well, Erica, welcome to the podcast. I'm really glad to have you. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself? Just whatever you'd like people to know about your family, your ministry, your writing?
Yeah, sure. My name is Erica Anderson. I live in suburbs of Indianapolis, Indiana. So grew up here in the Midwest. And I am a wife and a mom. I have two kids. My daughter is 7. My son is 10. And I've been writing really my whole life, but writing more professionally, I guess, freelance writing for about the past 7-8 years. And it's been amazing to be able to use that gift in a lot of ways. I feel very privileged that I love to write and I get to do it for a living, and just like praise God that I get to do that. And I just came out with my third book, which we're going to talk about today, Freely Sober.
So we'll just jump in. Do you want to tell a little bit of your story and what led you to write this book?
So I, you know, grew up in a pretty much like non-denominational evangelical household. And so I had a pretty typical upbringing and like had a great family and everything. But like a lot of people, experimented with alcohol in high school as a teenager. And, you know, not it doesn't end badly for everyone. But for me, it kind of got me started down a really unhealthy pathway. And so throughout the next 20 years from like 17, 20 years after that, I was kind of going back and forth with just this really unhealthy relationship with alcohol, where there was a lot of guilt and shame. There was a lot of overdrinking at times. I also was the kind of person that occasionally would get blackouts, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. Like it's really a biological thing, but that's pretty scary when you get a blackout. And I would just have these constant back and forth moments with myself and with God where it was like, I know I should get alcohol out of my life, but I really just don't feel like I can. It's integrated into everything we do in society and it's fun. And I'm afraid that I'll stop being fun, or, you know, it's like there were good and bad things. And so it was really hard for me to reconcile getting rid of it. Especially when I was younger, in my 20s, especially, it's like, I'm in my 20s. Like I can't, you know? But when I got into my 30s and just getting a little older, becoming a mom, you know, you begin to sort of recognize your mortality a little bit there. And also when you have kids, it really shifts your priorities. And so, it was around that time that I kind of moved more towards, could this be possible? And it was also when I started kind of drinking more at home, like a lot of wine every night, and just starting to feel like this is really getting out of my control in a way that does not feel good. And so eventually I kind of pursued being curious about what does sobriety look like or how could I do this? And tried and failed a few times. Eventually though, I was able to quit. So I quit 5 years ago. And it's been a journey of learning and also just, you know, being able to share my story along the way. I've been able to really connect with a lot of people and speak for people that don't feel like they have a voice sometimes. And just speak for that person that's in the middle, like, that isn't the stereotype that people think of as a person that has a drinking problem. You know, a lot of people think they shouldn't have a problem. And so they just kind of ignore it and never deal with it. And so I'm kind of speaking for those people because that's who I was from the outside looking in. You would not have known I had a problem. And that doesn't mean that you don't though. So
that's really helpful. Thank you for sharing that. And we're going to get more into it as I'm asking you questions as we go, but I really appreciated hearing your story, like hearing the back end of that, because I do think that there are a lot of things that people stereotypically think about addiction that may not be what it actually is like or what it actually looks like for everybody. There are some things in common, but a lot of those we're able to mask, I feel like, in public spaces a lot of times. And so, or a lot of things happen in secret, and so everybody wouldn't know all those things. So I really appreciate the way that you bring a lot of that up. And I'd really like to ask you, what are some of the common misperceptions you find people have about alcohol, dependence, or just addiction in general?
Well, I think it's almost like people think unless you have a really, really bad problem, then it doesn't count or something. Or, you know, it's like, you know, people Google all the time that are kind of questioning this, like, well, am I an alcoholic or what is an alcoholic? I mean, the Googling is out there, and it's because they're trying to figure it out. And it's a very gray area. But, you know, typically people are thinking if you're an alcoholic, you're someone that's out of control. You're at the work party and you're being inappropriate, or maybe you're driving when you shouldn't, or, it's very clear, like you're slurring your words, or, you know, just have a reputation. And that's honestly, like, that's actually not the case most of the time. Because people, you know, drinking is so accepted and, everywhere that you can totally respectably be getting your wine every night and drinking it, and nobody's going to say anything or, notice or call you out. Partially, number one, people don't want to call anyone else out because they don't want to stop drinking. But also, like, they don't want to offend you. So I think it's just like there's such a gray area that it's really hard for people to be able to define what it is. And when you can't define it, I think people run away from it. And so, you know, I want to say that if it's a problem, it's a problem, no matter how big or small. And if you're thinking about it and there's something prompting you to make changes, it's worth listening to that. You don't need to wait until you get to some really low place to make a change. We don't want to get to that place. So you can do it now.
That's a really great way of thinking about it. You're right. It is such, I don't want to use this word necessarily, but like a spectrum of what it can look like. And anywhere on that spectrum that it's taking too much space in your head, in your relationships, in your health, anything like that, I think it's always a good idea to notice that and pay attention even before it gets to like a really terrible
right,
place.
Right. And it's a very individual, you know, it's like your body is its own unique entity, you know? And so how much you drink, when you drink, why you drink, all of those things are going to be different for every single person. And so it's worth exploring some of the background noise that's going on there. If there is any, if there's any even hesitation, it's like, well, why not figure it out? Because, it is an addictive substance. It can be destructive, and it's not just this benign thing that never causes any problems.
Right. Yes. So specifically, you write your book, it seems like, to women of faith, and you write a lot about how alcohol affects women specifically. Can you share some of the cultural or marketing changes that have affected women's relationship with alcohol over the last few decades?
Yeah, I think really the alcohol marketing started targeting women in the 90s. I believe that's when it started. And it really was just this realization that they had of, you know, they started marketing some girly drinks, and all of a sudden they realized, oh, when we basically sell the same drinks that we sell guys, but put a pink label on it and call it something about women, women are excited to drink it, and they actually will even pay more, which is sometimes called the pink tax. Like, women will pay more just because it's pink, which is crazy, but true. And so as the marketing ramped up, they just started, oh my gosh, like, we've been not marketing to women all these years, and women really ate it up. It was sold very much so as an empowerment thing. Like, you can be just like the guys, you deserve to relax too. And it all sounds so kind of simple and just like, really, that worked, but it actually did work. And you started seeing it everywhere, and they really were getting into the minds of women and what they wanted. And, you know, marketing is very powerful. So that was, you know, that was one part of it. And then I also think, you know, the increase in drinking is just related to modern life. I think, we just pack more and more into our lives. I think we're kind of living as women a lot of times in this modern world. We're living lives that we almost like shouldn't be living because we are doing too much. We're trying to pack it all in. We're expected to do all these things. And so it's like, in order to cope, rather than sort of downsizing or really taking inventory, we're just being like, well, I'm supposed to do all this, so I'm going to get through it. And so that's something else. And the reality is that alcohol does affect the female body in different and more devastating ways than it does men. And so because of that, we're paying the price and we're seeing alcohol-related deaths in women have increased by since 1999 by almost 300%. And so that's crazy. And men's rates increase as well, but women's rates of alcohol-related deaths are increasing at a far higher pace. And so we're just seeing after all these years, oh, it's really coming back down on us in so many ways. And I do think now we're getting to the point where we're starting to have better conversations and recognition of what alcohol has done to us. But man, it took a while to get here. But I am thankful for the current conversations that are happening.
That is fascinating, devastating, and fascinating all yes. at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was not in my questions ahead of time, but it's something I'm thinking about as I'm talking to some clients, as I was reading your book, now as you're talking about it. I don't know, you don't use this word in your book, but from a counseling perspective, I think of states of regulation a lot when it comes to self-medicating, because mm-hmm. What you're talking about is we do live a life that is very stressful. Almost like a hypervigilant, like somebody can get in contact with you all the time, work life, school life blends into home life, but you have all yeah. the responsibilities, but anybody can get in touch with you about those responsibilities at any point yes. in the day. There's no like stop point, you know? So yeah. our bodies are kind of like living in this fight or flight state. So one way of saying that is living in dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And so then we take coping things to kind of medicate ourselves to feel better, to not be living in that like fight or flight state, because it's so awful to have to live like that all the time. But mm-hmm. a lot of us really are living like that all the time. Sometimes mm-hmm. due to trauma, sometimes to things that we don't have control over, sometimes just due to modern life and how everything's fast paced and there's like stuff coming at us all the time. And you talk a lot in your book too about how women specifically have a mental load that they're carrying and mm-hmm. that they're having to perform in many areas all the time that we maybe aren't necessarily paying attention to or giving them credit for. And so mm-hmm. do you think a lot of times that is why we turn to alcohol, is to help our bodies feel less dysregulated?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think self-medication is a term that I really resonate with and used it a lot. I mean, of all the terms, that may be the one that resonates with me the most, because I think you just see this so much in our culture of just, okay, well, if you have a problem, like what's the thing that we take to fix the problem? And this is not just alcohol, of course, like it's all kinds of pharmaceuticals that people take to try to solve like one problem when really it is such a bigger deal than you taking a pill to make it go away. It's very integrated into your whole person, and it's spiritual and it's mental and it's all these things. And when you take a pill or you take a drink, like you're just kind of numbing it for a second, making it go away, but it doesn't go away. It's still there. And so I think it's hard for women because in order to actually evaluate that, all of that, they might have to stop for a second. They might have to go to therapy or, you know, not work so much or, you know, something, let go of something. And I understand, like, for some women, that's almost feels impossible if they are bringing in, you know, a big portion of the income for their family, or, you know, even just like they carry the weight of their productivity or their output as like, this is my worth and value. And it's really hard to separate from that. But it's just like, yeah, like you were saying, with all the notifications and all the things, people getting in touch with us, I think the people that you see stepping back and really slowing down and taking inventory of their lives, like those are the ones we see getting healthier. And we're just kicking the can down the road when we just keep drinking or taking a pill, like you're just until you get older. And then, you know, I think this for me was a big one. I always say, I thought to myself, do I still want to be dealing with this problem when I'm 75? And it's like, you don't want to look in the mirror 10, 20 years from now and be like, I never figured it out and I'm still in this. And that does require some like pauses. And I guess I would encourage people, like, it is worth taking the pause. And I need to take more pause. I need to take more pauses in my life because I still have too much going on.
Me too.
Even though I'm not drinking anymore, I don't stop enough. But like that, you know, that plays out in other ways. And I think it just kind of goes like, hey, we just have this one life. We just have this one life and what really matters. And maybe if we took away some of the things that didn't quite matter as much, we wouldn't feel like we needed to medicate other things away. I don't know. That's kind of a random way of saying it, but
yeah. Yeah. I think that's really helpful. Thank you. I kind of resonated with one little section and it was like one or two lines that you wrote, but I wanted to have a conversation about it. You said, in your book, you talk about the wine witch or mm-hmm. a voice that sober people use for the voice that compels them to drink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in my office, I tend to work with, clients who have disordered eating or eating disorders. It's not fully what I do, but some of what I do. And, also clients who have OCD. In both of those cases, we identify the voice in the head because it's so strong and we need to be able mm-hmm. to identify like, okay, this is not my normal thinking voice. This is like mm-hmm. a voice that's compelling me to do something right now. And then like, what is the tone of that? Almost like that voice in my head, like what's the tone there? What is it trying to get me to do? How do I recognize when it's showing up as apart from my regular thinking? So to me, this sounds very similar. So for you, like, how did you come to identify that voice and what kinds of things or like what tone of voice sort of does that voice in your head have?
Yeah, well, it is like the word compel is like such a definitive term that makes so much sense. And people in communities I've talked with, like, it's that compulsion, which is just this moment, especially like a triggering moment where you just feel like it's saying like it, the voice, whatever the voice is saying, like, I want this, I want it right now. Like I have to get it. And, you know, for people that are deep into it, and even myself, I experience where you feel like you may feel very strong all day. And then, you know, a certain time or moment hits and you hear that voice and you almost feel like you can't not do it. It feels like you have to do it. Like almost like I hear the voice and then I'm like, oh no, oh no. Like I don't want this, but like, I can't make this go away unless I do the thing that it says. And so that is what happens. And I also had an eating disorder, for a long time. And there were some very similar feelings there with, mm-hmm. especially with, binge eating, like the feeling of wanting to go binge eat, similar feeling to wanting to go drink, mm-hmm. to me in a lot of ways. It's really interesting how it compares.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's so, and then, you know, but it's interesting that I was able to overcome that thing, you know, the eating side. And so that actually gave me a lot of insight to be able to say, you know what, I was able to overcome that. Like, I don't have that anymore. So that tells me that it's possible to overcome this same voice. And, you kind of have to learn to first identify and recognize what it's saying and like, then be rational and logical. It's like, well, like, let's think here. Like, do I really have to do what it's saying? Or why is it saying that? You know, you really need to like take notes on your life and observe yourself. Like what's happening before, during, and after this? And like, you know, is there something, you know, doing the classic hungry, angry, lonely, tired, halt. Like hunger was huge for me. Like I was always triggered to drink if I was hungry. Now, some of that was like related to my eating disorder because it was like, oh, if I drink, then my hunger will go away for a while. And, you know, it was like a weird twisted, but it was connected for me. And if I was very full, I actually didn't want to drink when I was full. So, that has been interesting. And it's kind of funny now because I used to like never want to eat dinner until really late. It's like, well, I can't have a buzz if I've eaten dinner, and now I'll eat dinner like 5 and I don't care, you know? But it, you know, in a way it kind of helped me get more healthy with eating again as well. So
interesting. So like listening to your body, noticing all the cues. Yeah.
Yeah. And good. You know, there are things that you may assume are happening for a certain reason, but when you actually sort of like just observe and you see sort of the patterns, you may go, oh, that makes so much sense that I was feeling that way. And just being able to identify that kind of thing can give you a tool to overcome it. And the more you do use the tools and the pattern, the new healthy habits, like the stronger you feel and the more that you begin to realize that you have a lot more power than you think you do.
Yes. Yes. You wrote a quote for someone in the sobriety community that said, "It finally hit me that I didn't have a problem with alcohol. The problem was I was using alcohol as the solution." I really love that quote. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really alcohol that is the problem when you think about it, because you're never really drinking for the alcohol. And as you know, going back to the self-medicating comparison, that's, you know, you're using it. You're using it. You're not drinking it. You're using it like a drug. And that's exactly right. And so it's like exploring what are those reasons that you're using it for? And like, what is something else you could do in order to find a solution to that problem? Because what really happens, you just kick the can down the road and continue to have that same problem if you don't deal with it. And it will still be there in 10 years if you don't deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, from a lot of people that I know and also the things that I read in your book, I mean, I think that there's not always just one reason that we're using it. It can be like multifaceted. There may be one reason why you start using it, but then it starts helping in lots of different areas. So then it can be like a lot of work maybe to uncover all the things it was doing for us. We may not know right off the bat, what is this doing for me?
Yeah. And I always go back to an example from when I did go through some treatment for eating disorder a long time ago is, you know, I went to this therapist and she was saying like, you should do this outpatient program. And it was very expensive. And I was like, oh, that's so expensive. I don't want to ask my parents to pay for that. And, you know, that seems like a lot of time. I'm in college right now. Like, and she was like, but wouldn't it be worth it if your life got better and you were free from this? I'm like, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And so it's like, wouldn't it be worth the time, the money, the effort that it takes? Because regardless of if you get, you know, exactly where you want to be, you are going to grow and you are going to be able to more clearly hear from God. I mean, there's a lot of barriers and fuzziness when you're putting a substance in your body. And so I would say, really, what do you have to lose? And really just taking a minute to like think very deeply about your actual life and what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, what do you have to lose? A lot, I guess.
Well, yeah,
that's a hard decision. But when you think about it logically, yeah. What do you
right,
have to
you
lose?
Right. You have some things to lose, but like, aren't they in the end like kind of worth losing if you really receive the freedom and like just the goodness that comes from getting this out of your life?
Yes. Yeah. I often think about addiction as being like almost like a best friend or like a boyfriend who's abusive. It's like, you don't want to get rid of them because what's going to take its place, and it takes up so much space and it is supportive in a way, but then also it's destroying you too. So it's
so much like an abusive relationship because it's like, it's always promising like that it's going to make you feel better and it's good in the moment. And like, you know, when you're saying you're not going to do it, but then it's like, but it's so great. Remember all the good times we had together, you know, and it really does. And then it's like, once you don't feel good or once the anxiety hits or you have a hangover, it's like nowhere to be seen and it can't help you. And so it's so silly. It feels silly to talk about a substance like that, but it really is so devastating to so many people. I mean, it clearly has a lot of power. That's why we have so many people in AA, so many people in Al-Anon. Everyone knows somebody who alcohol has caused major issues in their life. So this is, if you're struggling with it, it's actually pretty normal. And it makes sense that you're not just totally not having any issue simply because it is addictive and it's kind of intended to do this.
Right. Yeah. So I know my listeners are tired of me talking about the importance of community because it comes up all the time. But when it comes to recovery, community is really huge. And I love this quote in your book, "The opposite of self-medicating might be community medicating." And then you say, "Introverts, you're included." That made me laugh. What's been the role of community and relationship in your process of healing?
Yeah, I mean, it's true, like, that God did not, I mean, God made us for community, whether you're a Christian or not. Like, we are all made for community as image bearers of God, in my opinion. And so I think that's why even people outside of like a church space, like, really find so much goodness, whether it's a sports team or a recovery group, like, there's always so much good that comes out of that. And so for me, you know, it really starts with my church. I have a wonderful church, and that's been huge for me as a support tool. And I had a small group at, when I first was dealing with this, that was a really big confidant for me. But then also when I joined a recovery group online where they had meetings every day on Zoom, this was during COVID when they first started. All their meetings are still on Zoom pretty much because now the community exists nationwide. But that was so powerful. It's like, just to like hear other people talking about it in ways that you sometimes you relate to, sometimes you don't, but you just start to realize that like your problem isn't abnormal. There are other people struggling every day. You can go every single day and like say what you're dealing with, and people will have encouraging words for you. People will share their phone number with you. And so I think you have to have people that you can talk to. And I think in the beginning, you have to make a habit of that. Like every time, like tell someone, talk to someone. And if it has to be a recovery group online where you don't show your face at first, like that's fine. Lots of people start that way. But there are a lot of options these days outside of just AA, even though AA is a perfectly good option as well.
Yeah. So for you, I mean, reading through your book, especially, I gathered like in person and people who didn't necessarily have alcohol addiction were also supportive to you, but you also had a community of people who really got it, who were going through it themselves. Do you think it's important to have both?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, at its core, everyone does something to deal with their, you know, their inner internal strife. We all have it. We all have something that is a vice or something that we deal with. So
some of us are more self-aware about that than others, I think.
True.
You're right.
True.
You're
yeah.
Right.
But I, you know, I like to just be like, you know, a lot of times with the drinking stuff, we tend to put ourselves down and really say, this is what I did. You know, you don't have enough willpower or enough self-discipline. But in reality, like, we're really just trying to make ourselves feel better and fix something. And I think when people see it or hear it explained that way, that can be helpful because it's like, oh, I was actually just trying to help myself, but I didn't know how. And so I think people that don't deal with alcohol can relate to that on different levels. And I think it's important to have a variety of people and influences in your life, like older, younger, same age. But then, of course, the people that do have that particular struggle, like, are like a real safe haven because, you know, it's, I remember the first time I got together with, this woman in my community, like, I don't remember, I think we had found each other through the online group and it was like, who lives in Indianapolis? So anyway, we met up for coffee and it was just such a relief and like, almost like fun to be like, oh, let's talk about this and like trade war stories on this. Like, not that that's like a fun activity, but just somebody that got it. Like everything I said, oh yeah, like I totally have been there. And so it doesn't matter what it is, whatever problem that you have, I am the first thing I do, no matter what problem I have, is like, go find a community. I'm like, where's the Facebook group for this problem I'm having? Because there are people there. I just want to be able to say what I want to say and what I'm feeling. And I want people to go, I know exactly how you feel and you're totally normal. And this is what I did. I mean, I can't tell you enough how helpful that is and how you just don't feel alone. You feel seen. And then you also see people who are further along than you and you can be like, oh, okay, I can envision this now.
There is something about really being seen and understood that really facilitates healing, I think.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Two, I know that you weren't always drinking secretly, like you were drinking with other people, but I don't know that other people knew the struggle that you were having. And a lot of that really is secretive and internal. So being able to take that out into the open in a safe space, it's really freeing.
Yeah. And it's still now, I mean, when I started sharing more publicly, you know, I had people in my family, they're like, what? Like totally confused. I always say like I'm kind of known in my family. I'm like, I'm the one they asked to pray at Thanksgiving dinner. I'm the one that's, you know, I was going on mission trips and leading. I'm known as like the church girl, really. And so it's really was kind of shocking, I think, to people when I came out and told them this. But in a way, I mean, that does what I wanted to do, because it shows people that like there are people hidden in plain sight. And I still feel a little weird sometimes, like with my book coming out last week, I felt very vulnerable just because I knew everyone, like, who, you know, when I write things online, which I do all the time and put online, who knows if people are like really reading them. But if you buy someone's book and you're reading it, like you're really reading it.
Right.
So I'm like, my family members, and mostly my family is who I'm thinking of, are going to read this. And, you know, I'm not too worried about it. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, this is, makes me feel really vulnerable. Because
yeah, it's your story.
Even my sister the other week said, you know, how do you, or she was interviewing me for something, but because she's a podcaster as well. But she was like, sometimes I see some of the stuff you've put out there and I'm like, really surprised that you're telling it. And I'm like, well, but like you need like the details are what people find relatable. Like if it's very vague, but if you're able to say this is what happened and it's like, oh, like even she did something like this, I think it just gives people more courage to realize like that they're not alone and that it's not, they're not like the maybe the bad person or the kind of person they've made themselves out to be in their head, because they're not going to judge me that way.
Right.
You know? Most of the time they don't, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really humbling in a way if we've struggled and then we share our struggle with others. And also I think really it facilitates the things in us that Christ wants to be doing anyway, because naturally we tend to not be very humble, right? Or dependent. And mm-hmm. So as soon as you're vulnerable in that way, like number one, you're learning to be dependent on him mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. maybe others, like in a more healthy way. And also it is really vulnerable and humbling. But in my life, I'll just say, even though that is the case, that's when the Lord has done the most for me in a way too. And I think probably used me in other people's lives as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anytime that you are working on giving something up like this in your life, I mean, just that's you just know God's going to work. I mean, it's like when people, I still can't get myself to do fasting. partially, I think it's like a mental thing, linking back to my eating disorder days. So, you know, I kind of give myself a pass on that simply because of that history. But at the same time, I have heard just these incredible stories from people that have had fasting experiences where they just hear from God in such a powerful way. Mm-hmm. And so to give something up is a bit like a fast.
Yes.
And like God is going to work through that, especially if it's like you're being faithful to him and like he is like going to bless that obedience. And, you know, I don't know how, but like it, you will experience the goodness of God in that obedience, in my opinion. And he, is going to just use that for so much good. And I always have that picture of, and I think I wrote this metaphor in the book of the little girl that has the ratty old teddy bear and her dad is asking her, give it to me. I'm going to, you know, come on, I need to take this away. You know, behind his back, he has this like brand new, like beautiful thing that he wants to give her, but she doesn't know that she hasn't seen it yet. And it's like, I've heard that so many times, but it really is such an apt metaphor to be like, I thought of that metaphor before I stopped. And I thought to myself, I know God has something for me. I just have to have enough faith to step out and believe it. And he did. So, he always has something better, you know, mm-hmm. than if we're living in our sin. And I'm not saying addiction in and of itself is sin. I think there's a whole lot of layers to that conversation.
Me too.
Yeah. So, I do think that like if we step out of that in trusting him, like he is not going to let us down with that. He's going to bless that, and he has in so many ways.
You also wrote, I think near the end of your book, and I really liked this. You said, "Here's what sobriety taught me. The joy is not in the wine, but in the company. The fun is not in the beer, but in the experience. The laughter is not in the martini, but in the conversation." So in my life, I mean, I'll be honest too, and my listeners probably know this, they probably heard it before, but I had an eating disorder earlier in my life, and thankfully I've been recovered for a long time, but that addiction propensity, whatever, is definitely all up in my family, and I can get hyper-focused on new things really fast, and so I really have to watch that in myself with any kind of substance, anything really, you know, I can just like latch on. But I bring that up because when I'm working with people, and I see this in myself too, like when you're in the middle of something like that, any kind of addiction, any kind of like a compulsion, that kind of thing that can be all encompassing and that can look like a lot of different kinds of things. It's almost like we're not fully living our lives. Like part of our brain is always taken up with this other thing. Or we may not be fully present with people. We might be thinking about other things or like thinking about when we're going to get our next ... you know, whatever. Or wishing that we could be at the end of the day when we were drinking our wine, however you want to think about that. And so I'll tell a lot of my clients, like, what we think about recovery is not necessarily that this behavior is completely ended or we're no longer having the thoughts or anything like that. It's more like real life is starting to take back over and you realize you're with people and you're actually present and, you know, like a lot of time elapsed and you didn't have those thoughts. And all of a sudden you realize you're like, I'm actually living my life like much more engaged than I used to be. And that is a really great thing. And that's what I thought of when I read that. Is that what it felt like for you or how would you think about sobriety?
Yeah, no, I just think that, for a lot of us, alcohol has been so integrated and overlapping into every part of our life. It's a part of so many memories. And so there is even a grief involved in letting it go because, you know, every part of it wasn't bad. And we have great moments with friends and family and holidays and all this stuff. And so I think people often think like all of that's going to go away. And they're just like saying no to all of that good stuff. But the reality is that because it's kind of like a science experiment. Like you didn't put it over here to the side by itself. And for that reason, you credited alcohol with the fun and the experience and the atmosphere. You gave it so much credit, not realizing that so much more of the credit really goes to the people and the activity and the thing that you're doing. You know, there's a lot of people in, you know, beginning of sobriety where they do all their sober firsts. They first concert, first holiday, first this and that. And my first concert, I remember thinking, I kind of took it as an experiment. I was like, all right, like, see if I can have fun. And as I was doing that, you know, I'm hanging out with friends and I was like, I feel like I'm drunk right now, but I'm drinking water. But then I was like, no, that's not what it is. I'm just having fun and I'm just with people and it's like a buzzy atmosphere and like it's exciting and there's energy. And it wasn't the alcohol really that was doing it. And it was such a revelation to me when that happened, because I all that time thought the only reason I had fun at things was because I was drinking, and it's really not the case. And so I think you do get an authenticity back into your life. And it is really hard at first. It can feel like white knuckling at first, but it does dissipate with time. And once you get over the hump, you really look back and are so thankful that you're not in that cycle anymore. You're not in that constant mental load of the rules, the moderation, or just the oppressive thoughts. It does take up so much mental space. I mean, just so much. And then I'm praying about getting free from this. I'm spending like all my spiritual time with God talking about this. Like, well, gosh, I don't talk about that at all anymore because it's not a problem. So what can I now fill my prayers with, you know, and think how much God can do with that. So
that is such a great perspective. Yes. Thank you for that. And that's such a great story about the concert.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a concert does create a lot of dopamine and like all the good stuff from being with lots of people. It is a natural high, but I never thought about it quite like that before. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really cool. And I am, you know, I will say I'm an extrovert, so I enjoy getting energy from crowds. But I think, you know, everybody can kind of tailor that to their own personality and lives. And it works in all different ways.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Is there anything you would like to share that I didn't give you a chance to?
guess just like, I guess I just want to say to follow the feeling that you have. If you're listening to this and you feel like anything resonates, like to just move forward without pressure on yourself, which is why the book is called Freely Sober. Because, you know, for me, when I felt boxed in, like it was something I had to do, I couldn't do it. But when you give yourself the freedom to choose and do it for the like reasons of, you know, more, you feel better, you know, when you, you know, kind of do your research and you get to a point where you're actually choosing instead of feeling forced. That's how it is with so many things. I mean, it's also just one more thing, take it back to the eating disorder. When I was trying to get over this binge eating disorder, I read a book that was like, basically like, just eat what you want and like, see what happens. And like, how does that change your mindset? And it's kind of in a similar way, like when you let go of the rules and just like give yourself permission, like you then have the freedom to actually like have autonomy back about this situation. And then you start to feel like you're not, I don't want to say in control, and that controlling isn't the greatest wording, but just like when you feel like you have the autonomy to say yes or no, like that's so big. And yes. So that's why I say Freely Sober. The book is really intended to give people like just a lot of information, assessments, questions, and just like walk you through it without any pressure to be like, well, I hope you get sober by the end of this book. Like, which is definitely, that's not the main goal here. Or even a goal. The goal is for you to learn something about yourself, learn something about alcohol, learn something about God. And then at the end of that, if you know something that you didn't know before, you might make different choices based on that information. So open your mind and heart up to some of that.
I love that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So where can people find you in your book?
Yeah. You can learn more about the book at freelysober.com. But you can just buy it on Amazon if you're totally sold already. Freely Sober by Erica Anderson. It is on Amazon, Christian book, all everywhere books are sold. And then you can find me on Instagram, Erica_Anderson. And I will say right now, I do have bonuses on freelysober.com. If you buy it and you turn in your receipt, I have like a private podcast, a 30-day guide to sobriety. And I have this little product called Sober Scripts, which is basically like 60 to 70 different situations you may find yourself in. And each of those have like a Bible verse, an action item, a prayer, just so you can be like, okay, I'm going on a first date. Here's my sober script for how to handle not drinking on this date. So those are just a couple of thank yous for buying the book, and you can get those at freelysober.com.
Awesome. Okay. I will link to that on today's show notes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. It's always interesting. Different questions, different people always spark new conversations I've never had before. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Erica, for being on today's podcast episode. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you, getting to hear your story, both in person and in your book. Friends, if you enjoyed this conversation and you'd like to know more, I hope that you'll go check out Erica's book, Freely Sober. I also hope you'll go check out her website, freelysober.com, so you can check out some of those resources she talked about at the end of today's episode. At the end of her book, she also has a bunch of resources as well, including books that might be helpful, memoirs that might be helpful, supportive communities, non-alcoholic drink brands. There are some really great information, so you guys go check it out. Well, I hope you're coming away from today's episode with a little more knowledge than you had going in, maybe a different perspective. And I also hope it gives us more compassion for those in our midst, maybe even ourselves, who are struggling and hidden in plain sight. Well, that is all for today's podcast episode. I'm Jenny Detweiler with PRN. Pause, renew, next. May you be encouraged on your journey with Jesus.